Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling some of the stories of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes from working with the likes of Beyonce, Guns N' Roses, Elvis Presley, David Bowie, The Beatles, Queen, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, the 1975, Oasis, Bob Dylan and Kraftwerk. As regular listeners know, our mission, as mentioned, is to provide a spotlight on some of these kind of unsung champions, if you like, of the music industry, and that could not be more apparent than today, as we're joined by creator of Independent Venue Week, Sybil Bell, who'll be talking us through what we can do as musicians and as music fans to support some of the local venues right now and going forward. We'll be sharing some of the stories from a quite inspirational career, also as an artist manager and tour manager, and telling us about the new film in which she features heavily, Long and Winding Road, which superbly documents Radiohead drummer Phil Selway travelling the UK night after night, exploring the current state of UK grassroots venues during Independent Venue Week. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Sybil Bell. Thanks for joining us today, Sybil. How's it going?
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Lovely. Now, if we had done this interview a year ago, and we're recording this in September 2020, and it could be a case that we might be on the cusp of a second wave of coronavirus, we're not sure, but that could be a case. And I was to ask you a year ago, what are the key risks on the horizon then facing independent venues? What would you have answered, and how does that differ to now?
I think a year ago, by September, we're in full planning, getting everything ready mode, and we know clearly what we're doing. We've done 7 independent venue weeks already. We're about to do our 8th, and it's a well-oiled machine. It doesn't mean it doesn't have its lumps and bumps along the way, but we know pretty much how to make it happen. I think a year ago, the biggest risk to venues was really the lack of understanding at quite a high level of the significance of these venues as local cultural hubs around the country. So they could be impacted from planning decisions, people not really going to venues enough, so they start to lose money and then want to close. You know, the whole point of Independent Venue Week was to be a celebration. You see so often when a venue is threatened with closure that people rally around and say, save this venue. Well, where were you last week, last month, last year? You know, and I think there's been a certain apathy around venues and what they mean, and almost that they've been taken for granted. Of course, they'll always be there. That's where the new talent starts, whether it's on stage or off stage, especially for crew. And so I think the biggest threat has just been complacency. And like I say, a little, you know, some issues around planning, but nothing on the scale that we're seeing now, of course. So that's really the biggest difference. I mean, we've grown year on year, the number of venues that have taken part. And last year we had 230. We started in year one when it was just me with 17 venues. In year two, we jumped to 91. That was an interesting year to just have that leap. I say interesting with inverted commas. But by, you know, within 5 years, we'd grown the number of venues tenfold. We hadn't grown the staff tenfold or the income or anything else. So it's been a huge undertaking. And we're there because of the venues. We're there to support them. And I think and I hope, you know, with the support that we've had, incredible support we've had from Six Music and the BBC and all parts of the media and the artist community, people get the project as a really simple premise to understand. And I'd like to think that because of the involvement of everyone who takes part, that the risk that you were just asking about has started to be mitigated somewhat. There is less complacency. People understand why the venues are important. They understand that perhaps they should go to more gigs. You know, we always say if you go once a month, go twice. If you go once a week, maybe go twice. If you go once a year, go twice. Just make a bit more effort to be part of it, and then they'll be around.
And as we're recording this now, there's been a lot of talk in the last few months about, I mean, we're talking about UK here, and we have listeners all over the world, but in the UK specifically, we're kind of looking at arts funding, and initially there was a lot of press about, so New Zealand found $175 million to support the arts industry, and there was nothing from the UK government for a while, and then Rishi found 1.5 billion that was given to the arts in the UK. Does that filter into independent venues? How does that work? And was that a surprise, or was it more than you expected? Is it what is needed?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I'm going to just be very blatant here. We've got the wrong government in place to really care too much about the arts. And I think if you follow me on social media, you'll see that I've taken a bit of a break in the last month, but I've never really held back from that. And it is quite a worry that the government had to be coerced into finding this, money, and their lack of understanding of non-high arts is quite remarkable, as far as I'm concerned. And
what do you class as high arts?
Well, opera, ballet, yeah. Classical music. It's a bit like that episode of Yes, Minister, when Humphrey's going off to the opera. And it's textbook stuff, isn't it? And I think so much work has gone on in our community with Arts Council, with DCMS. You know, we've got venues that we work with speaking directly to government now, because that's been really important, that there's certain people and organisations that say they're speaking to government on behalf of different sectors of the industry, and they're not actually asking the community, they're telling them what they want, what the government wants to hear, and it doesn't work like that. So of course it was great when that money was found. It's amazing what money can be found when
the magic money tree, the DUP tree,
exactly. So it is really important, and there's so many sectors of the industry. It's been really interesting this lockdown just to see, of all the rescue packages that were out there, who still fell through the cracks. And if you look at creative industries as a whole, specifically arts and especially music, so many people work in this sector on a project basis. Mm-hmm. They're not fully employed by anybody. They would go from one project to the other. There's no regular income. That said, they might be on a project tour for 2 years. So that's fairly regular income. But they were falling through the cracks of all of the support, and they had no voice. And in fact, very early on into lockdown, Nathan at the Brudenell got in touch with a few of us and just wanted to check in and see how we were. And that conversation has snowballed over the last few months. And we are about to announce, obviously it'll be announced by the time this goes out, a new forum called the Council of Independent Live Music, which is there to bring together anybody who's an independent, a freelancer, anybody who feels that they're not part of an existing infrastructure, who work in live music. So that can be artists, managers, venues, promoters, agents.
Sound engineers.
Crew, yeah. Absolutely. Crew, I mean, crew are the ones that have really struggled more than most. Yeah. Merch companies, ticketing companies. And we want to have a platform whereby those people can come together and we can see what common ground we have with not just issues facing the industry during COVID, but beyond that, how we come together and work more closely. Because if you look at the infrastructure, and I think what's been really interesting, we've had this conversation about the council with other venues and promoters, but we have brought in the Featured Artists Coalition, the Music Managers Forum, Musicians Union, Association of Independent Music, some agents and some crew. And I think what's been really interesting about that is for all of us, we recognise and feel very passionately that you can't have the sector without everybody being a part of it. And so whilst we recognise and appreciate that the trade bodies that represent their sector do so effectively, there is nobody championing the whole grassroots sector at all. And that's so important. Mm. So we're really excited. I think Nathan's done a great job in corralling everybody, but we're really excited to see where this goes. And I think it will evolve organically. We're not there to dictate how things should be done. We're there to ask and feed that into people that can help make decisions.
What does success look like? So if, like, 5 years' time, what would you, you know, if everything went perfectly, what does that look like? Or is that defined by the very people who sign up for it?
For the council, I think in my head, it would show greater continuity between all of the parties, because very often some of the conversations that have been had during lockdown, and it's quite prevalent, you know, the crew really have had no voice. I know there's the PSA, but the conversations that we've been having within our community, not crew hasn't really come to the fore, but we've had agents come to us. A lot of agents have been let go because the agencies can't sustain them. There's nothing happening in live and they've set up on their own. And actually, we've had some very, I shan't say who was having those conversations, we've had some very powerful conversations where agents have been speaking to promoters, have been speaking to venues, have been, and the conversations have included artists. And actually, everybody wants the same thing. The infrastructure and the process as it is at the moment means that there's so many middle people and there's so many buffers. But actually, when you get grassroots people together, they've all got a vested interest in the show happening and it being accountable and transparent and fair. And I think success, from my perspective as a promoter and a platform, would be that there is more transparency, that shows happen much more easily, that there's less bureaucracy. More transparency is you know, needs to run alongside that. And I think that just, there's just more openness, because ultimately artists want to play shows, venues want to have them on, promoters want that to happen, ticketing companies want to sell tickets, agents want the shows for their artists. And actually, there's a lot more common ground between people than sometimes you would believe when you enter into negotiation to put a show on. So I get the sense that for me, success would be a much smoother, more transparent process for putting shows and tours together.
And obviously, that's been in response to what's happened and, you know, where we are right now. Going back to that figure of 1.5 billion, I mean, I do some work in the charity sector, and a similar thing happened where an announcement was made that a lot of money was, you know, an eye-opening figure was being kind of thrown into the charity sector. And even my mum messaged, "How is that great? It's like it's a drop in the ocean. Like that is nowhere near." It sounds big to you, but if you actually, it's not enough to cover everything. Firstly, is throwing money at a problem the answer? Which it may well be, but I'm interested in how you said about the high arts there and how equally distributed is that? And do we know yet if that is equally distributed and how people get access to it, how that works?
Well, it's been really interesting, actually. You know, conversations that we were having a few years ago is that rock, indie, you know, the sort of independent sector, bands, venues had never asked for money because they hadn't, because Arts Council really never made it easy. You know, the way that that high arts work is they have big teams of people, they have processes, and you know, the independent venues predominantly are working to such tight margins. We've been very fortunate to be funded by Arts Council England and other national arts councils, but Arts Council England came on board very early and sponsored us from year two onwards. And the process of filling out a grant application is not a simple thing. It's a fantastic thing to do in many ways because it makes you think about your cash flow and your project timeline for a big project like this. So it's been really useful. But for a venue who's just about keeping their head above water with, you know, the team that they can employ to do what they need to do, setting time aside to pull that together is very difficult. And I think with the Supporting Grassroots Live Music Fund, a lot of work was done to make sure that the application process was more intuitive. And I think Arts Council have been fantastic in the way they've responded to that. As COVID hit, all of the grant applications were withdrawn. All of the grant project grants were withdrawn. And everything went into a central pot. And there was a lot of unhappiness about that. But actually, I thought it was a really smart move, because how can you continue when some people's need is so much greater than others? So the big pot anybody was able to apply for, it was capped at 35,000. The project grants that, or the emergency arts fund that you could apply for, would run up to the end of October. You know, and back when they were pulling all this together, Arts Council were saying by then we hope to be able to reopen the grants. So the thing about the situation we're in now is we're working in an unknown. All we know is that we don't know what's going to happen. So I think they had a thankless task. But a number, and the data is readily available on the Arts Council website to see who got money. And there were a number of venues that got money just to keep themselves going. And that emergency fund was, do you need money for salaries? Do you need money for rent? Do you need money just to keep your business going? And then there was meant to be another 2.5 million coming just for venues. Actually, they managed to get 3.36 million. And that was for, you can apply for this fund if within a certain time period your business will not exist if you don't get this money. So and that they managed to get an extra million for that, so 3.36 million was distributed, again you can see it on the Arts Council website, to venues who, if they didn't get that money to cover emergency costs, would no longer be around. So I think the work that has been done has been fantastic, and I think the way Arts Council have pulled everything together and spoken to the community, which has been vitally important, has been, you know, really commendable. Going forward, there's a number of new grants. Now you talk about this 1.57 billion. They've just launched the, well, they've just finished taking applications for the Creative Relief Fund. And what's interesting about that, rather than the two grants that have gone before, that it's about assigning money. You can apply for money not just for your infrastructure and to keep going, but they want to see some activity. They want to see some creative output, which I think is really encouraging. Of course, we don't yet know what that will look and feel like, and it's the same for us for Independent Venue Week, but it's getting people thinking about what might be possible. And although a lot of creativity has been done virtually and digitally, we're finding ways to make that work. And so where some venues are open and having either socially distant gigs or just filming and streaming those, everyone's finding new ways to work because we're not used to not being busy. Nobody's used to this much inactivity, and it's tough for people. People want to be doing something. Paramount of importance is the safety and well-being of everybody and making sure we're working to whatever the government decides the guidelines are at that moment. But it's been really important. I think it's been really important for people to be able to think ahead about what they can do, even if it's all new for them, about the way they're delivering, you know, activity.
Is the music industry fair?
Oh, good Lord, Chris, how could you ask me that? Is the music industry fair? There's so many parts of it that are not fair, of course. You know, I think it's changed so dramatically in the last 10 years. You know, it used to be the case that tours were put on to sell albums. Now albums are released to support tours. That's where the live money is made. And it's been like that for some time. And, you know, the 360 deal and the majors taking a bigger chunk. The major labels have made so much money over the decades. And, you know, for the 10 artists that they would sign, they would hope that one would bring back enough money to cover the investment on the other nine. I think people are being a lot more cautious now. I think we're seeing a huge resistance to the streaming income and how it's distributed. Quite rightly, I would say. The major labels have got a big stake in the streaming companies, and it's in their interest to make sure that their revenue remains the same. But what lockdown has certainly highlighted, and even before lockdown, I think what gig goers, music fans, and the public are recognising more is the strength and the identity that being an independent means, whether you're a venue, an artist, a label. I think, you know, a lot of gig going public don't really understand or recognize what a promoter is necessarily. But anybody that's independent, there is a lot more sympathy and empathy towards that. And I think when streaming first was coming in and things went digital, gig goers were much more happy to pay for music if they knew that the majority of the money went to the artist. And I think it'll take a long time for that to evolve. But I think people have been a lot more creative about how they make money. You know, Cobalt was one of the first publishers to do an admin publishing deal. We're seeing lots of companies being sort of bolt-on marketing companies. And I think this is in reaction to the huge amounts of money in the industry that are going to a very, very, very few people, whether that's organisations or individuals. Now, behind the scenes, I know of some global selling artists that are putting money into venues, into COVID relief, and they're not saying who they are. And it's wonderful to see that happening. You kind of would like to tell people because they deserve the most enormous pat on the back, but that's not what they're there to do. But it's such a shame that it's tending to come from individuals, and a much larger chunk of the revenues that are being made during this period are not making their way back down to the community that needs them. Because when things hopefully go back to some sense of pre-COVIDness, we need this infrastructure. We need the crew, we need the buildings, we need the artists, we need the tour companies, the tour buses, the merch. It's part of the ecosystem. So I don't think it's fair at all. How we tackle it is a million-dollar question there.
So the new film that's going to be coming out at some point in the near future, you talked really nicely. So it's called The Long and Winding Road?
It's called Long and Winding Long Road, and Winding Road, yes. Yeah. We have to be very careful about the.
Knock, knock from Macca. The question I was going to ask about that, you really beautifully kind of said in that you know, the independent venues, they're almost like the development grounds, if you like, environment for new bands. So you've seen so many kind of new bands come through who've gone on to great things and other ones you might not have. And we have loads of young musicians listening to this. Mm. And what's an underrated skill do you think that every upcoming musician should have?
Oh, my God, being polite. I know that when you turn up and you've been on the road in a, you know, in a Vauxhall Nova or a van and you're knackered and you want a tea and you want to get your stuff in and you need a pee. You know, when you turn up to the venue, they've been putting up with a whole load of crap from all sorts of people. And just, a, you know, you can't be, hi, how are you? We always ask everybody, going to a shop, going to a, hi, how are you? And it catches people off guard. And it goes such a long way. And it doesn't matter how bad a day you're having. If you're nice to people, they'll be nice back to you. And that can change your mood immediately. And I know that sounds like a really basic thing, but try it if you haven't tried it. It goes a really long way. And I think it sets the scene for then how the rest of your afternoon and evening will go, how sound check will go. Even if you turn up and say, I'm just going to go and walk around the block for 5 minutes. I've had a rough journey and I don't want to come in with a, you know, bad head on. People understanding that will go a really long way. And actually, venues have you've got their own challenges. And I think if you can make sound check great and you're pleasant to people, you'll have a really great evening. And it sets the scene then for how the show will go, how you feel you're interact with fans, how you'll make new fans. So it's not even a music thing. I think it's just a
human quality.
Yeah, try wearing the other person's shoes that you're speaking to. And if everybody did that more often in life, I think we'd have a much happier world. I sound a bit knitted yogurt, don't I? But it really does go a long way.
No, absolutely. I think it's even now more than ever, I think it's a key message. I mean, what about kind of common personality traits? Or if you were to look through, you know, people, you know, I'm looking at your coat now and all the badges of bands and stuff like that that you've supported. If you were to look at kind of that pattern of the ones that have gone on and done what they wanted to and the ones who, you know, we all know them, you know, the people, even like myself, almost got there, never quite, and then what doing that analysis later. What do you think sets the two kind of parties apart? What's the fork in the road moment, do you think, from your experience watching now?
I think we're so fortunate with Independent Venue Week to have met some of my music heroes, and some have gone on to become incredibly good friends. And the common ground with everybody is that they're prepared to listen and take on board what other people say. I think it's so important, because as much as you care and feel passionate about what you're doing, you're in your own bubble. You know, we use the term echo chamber a lot now, but actually listening to advice and taking on board what people say, they're saying it generally for really good reasons. And whether that's creativity, whether that's musicality, whether that's, you know, as I was saying before, the way you behave when you turn up somewhere, I think there's such a need. I swim in the mornings. There used to be three lanes. There's now two because of COVID. But I liken it to the swimming pool. The people in the slow lane, the early bands, they're happy as Larry. They're doing their thing. They're finding their feet. The people in the fast lane, the bands at the top tier, couldn't be lovelier. They've achieved where they want to be. They're white. And it's the people in the middle that tend to have the most baggage, because they're desperate not to be there. And they're so keen to be in the fast lane. They're so keen to be at the top tier. And I think sometimes that can affect the way they behave towards people, or what they believe is they know best. And you've got nothing to lose by just taking 5 minutes to listen to what somebody's saying and you know, spending the night chewing the fat and thinking about it. I think that's the thing, is just being a bit more open.
That's great advice. And being, you know, in regards to getting developmental feedback, even if someone delivers that poorly to you, just try and have a look at, you know, what is the message they're trying to say in there, you know, that you can take away and reflect. That's really interesting. So let's talk about you and your development in regards to, you know, from where you began to where you are now with music. And I can see, obviously, you bleed music. And what was an album that was like a light bulb moment in your life? So it doesn't have to be your favourite album. It doesn't have to be the coolest album ever. But it's just, maybe there was a time you listened to something and the kind of, it reset your path. An album that you particularly...
Oh, I mean, God, another Another daring question there, isn't it?
That's what I'm
I think
for.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean that it's interesting, isn't it? That there's two or three records that are constantly on my turntable at home. One is Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, the other is Island Life by Grace Jones. Which just stand the test of time beautifully. But I let me have to be really careful what I say here, but I think one of the albums that really just set a very different path for me was when I was living in Australia back in between 92 and 94. I'm nearly 51, so I go back quite a long way. And I went out to Australia, a very sort of straight-laced, middle-class, I was going to say young lady, but I don't think that's ever been true, and discovered clubbing and having a really good time. And Screamadelica was an album that got played a lot, and I just lost myself in it. And my lifestyle at the time, I am not proud to say that I overstayed my visa and stayed in Australia longer than I should, because life was just so perfect and it was hedonistic and fun and free. And that album pretty much encapsulated everything about my time there. And I still listen to it all the time. There's certain tracks that I really can't listen to while I'm working because everything stops. But what Andrew Weatherall did with that album, and actually we were talking about it yesterday in the office, you know, we listened to, I've listened to the Memphis live album that they put out a year or so ago. Mm-hmm. And actually we were speaking to Simone from Primal Scream. She came into the office yesterday. She's a good friend of Oscar that works with us. And I was talking about the album. She said they couldn't have put it out at the time. She's absolutely right. It would have made no sense. Mm. But that mix that, you know, when Andrew got his hands on it and just hitting the zeitgeist, it was just, it's just giving me goosebumps here now, sitting, thinking about it. And I just think it was such a, it was so of its time. And I think that for me is, very special.
It's a crazy coincidence you say that. I didn't know you were going to say that because I'm, I've noticed in the one thing during lockdown that over the last few years, I don't feel I've listened to albums in the way that I should have done, you know, may or have done in the past. And it's probably interviewing a lot of people on podcasts. You listen to their back catalogue in research, and then you listen to Sick Music playlists to keep up to date. And the album hasn't been something I've listened to as much as I used to. So what I've been doing is I created a spreadsheet on my laptop.
Man of after every, my own heart.
of every album that was nominated or won the Mercury Prize going back to the 1992. And I'm working my way backwards. I'm only at 2016
What's
now.
A great idea. And how was the M people well, listen?
Well, I'm coming to that. But look at that, 1992, the
I
first winner.
Glasses.
The very first winner was Screamadelica.
I mean,
as I
really,
opened my spreadsheet.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, obviously, I've listened to that album, but that was the first ever winner of the Mercury Prize.
Yeah.
And so how did you, you know, listening to the album and obviously starting going to nightclubs? How did you then fall into this world you're in now?
Well, very, very accidentally, I came back from. Well, I was sent back from Australia in 1994. Got back.
Sent back.
I was deported. Sent back. I arrived back the week before Christmas Eve. I was going out with somebody at the time from Bolton, so I went from Bondi Beach in the summer to Bolton in the winter. It was the biggest culture shock, and I went back down to London, tried to get some work, and worked in the city for 10 years, running marketing departments for IT companies. I mean, really, socks and sandals and cartoon ties. But, you know, it was a job. It was hard to get work at the time. And I spent most of my money going out and enjoying myself. And I fell into music completely accidentally. My brother started running and has subsequently bought a venue called The Horn in St. Albans. And he had various promoters in there that were, you know, hit and miss. And I ended up working for myself, and I said I would go and help him out. So I'd work during the day for myself in an office on Great Portland Street, and then at 4 o'clock I'd pack up, go down to King's Cross, get the train to St. Albans, and spend the night working as the promoter for him. Mm-hmm. So it all happened accidentally. And then I started managing a band called Postwar Years, and then I ended up doing quite a lot of freelancing within the industry. So I worked at the Music Managers Forum. Webbo was one of the first people I ever met who actually created the, now that's what I call music, and also created the Mercury Prize. One of my heroes in the music industry, always wore flamboyant Hawaiian shirts and a very kind and generous man with his time. I worked at UK Music with Fergal Sharkey, which was an experience. Really? I have never seen anyone smoke a cigarette as quickly as he can.
He was on, I don't know if you've seen Bob Morton.
I did, yeah, I did. I must drop him a message, actually. And it was an interesting time, UK Music, because it's a lobbying organisation as much as anything. We did a couple of the party political conferences.
Right.
And there was a point where...
What year was this, roughly?
Ooh. 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, okay. Something like that. Mm-hmm. But there was a point that we were sat on Brighton beachfront behind all the security cordon, he and I smoking cigars, putting the world to rights, and it was just quite a surreal time. But it was interesting to work at the Music Managers Forum and UK Music to see how the industry worked from an industry point of view. I've never worked at a label. I've set up and run labels. But it was interesting to see how everything connects and also doesn't connect. You know, there was a term when we were at UK Music, it was like herding cats, because you're trying to get lots of different trade bodies who've got their own agenda to come together and find common ground and speak to government. And then I ended up working with somebody and we bought Moles down in Bath. That was a very horrendous experience. He was out of his depth and full of bullshit. And left me with huge debt and just really not a good man. And from there, I just ended up, because I was spending so much time there, I lost the band that I was managing and everything just went fut, really. Then I ended up working at the Featured Artist Coalition. And I was there for 6 months. And in fact, I pushed really hard to make sure that we as an organisation got out of London. You know, I love London, I live here, but there is a world outside London, and I think it's so important to engage with it. So I worked with a couple of the other trade bodies, and we did some sessions around the country. Ed O'Brien was gracious enough to come along and just talk to people outside of London about what the industry is, why the artists having a voice was really important. And I really enjoyed that. I also... what did I do after that? Gosh, it's been quite spread out. I also set up and ran something called FM because I wanted to meet people in the industry, and it was quite tough to do that as somebody, as you can tell, I'm a bit of a wallflower, Chris, right? Somebody's got a lot to say and keen to meet people, but finding those little pockets of how do you bring it all together? So I set up FM, which stood for First Monday, and the first Monday of every month, I said to people, we're going to be in this pub. Nice. In London, come down and meet other people. And it ran for 4 years, and we did some amazing talks. People like the American Embassy came down to talk about visas. I'm trying to think now who else was on there. But it was my way of meeting people and creating something. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you can't find your way in an industry, sometimes DIYing is the way to go. And I think that's part of being an entrepreneur. And it's also really important to not worry if you fuck it up. You know, I did that for 4 years. There were nights that were great. There were nights that were less great. And in the end, I decided to call it a day because it kind of ran its course and I was doing other things then. And it was while I was working at the FAC that I came up with the idea for Independent Venue Week, having owned a venue and that ending very badly for me, recognising that of all the areas of the industry that were championed or celebrated, the venue community wasn't. And I can't bear venue competitions. I can't bear venue awards. You know, how can somebody vote on, you know, Sneaky Pete's in Edinburgh and the Cavern in Exeter? What's the likelihood, if you're not a band, of you being
to both
of them? And also, our venue
community... What's the criteria of, like, one's
better than the other? Exactly. And our venue community work very closely with each other. Of course, sometimes there's competition, but actually they care about the community as a whole. So I didn't want it to be a competition. I didn't want somebody to win a bloody stupid award. And some of our venues now refuse to go along with the, you know, the Best Venue of the Year award because it's not really the spirit of what the community is about. But I looked at the Record Store Day model and I thought it was such a simple premise. But I think for venues, because I'd managed a band, I'd set up a label, I'd been a promoter, I'd owned a venue, I'd worked in trade bodies, I had quite a broad perspective on things, and I just felt that actually if you were going to do something that celebrated venues, it needed to be a week, because what goes on in a venue at the early part of the week changes as the week goes on. So you might have open mic nights, local bands, and then it touring artists and then bigger artists, and then Saturday might be followed by a club night, and then Sunday would very often be spoken word or more open mic night. So I made the decision to make it for a week because I felt that reflected what went on and it would allow us to have more time. And I thought that the end of January would be a good time to do it because there's not much going on in the news world. It's a great time for tipping new bands. A lot, but not all, as we've discovered. People do dry January and they're desperate to get out. And the footfall in venues has been really slow. Most don't even open for the first couple of weeks, or they didn't at the time. And it really kind of snowballed. And I approached a number of venues and said, this is the idea I've come up with. Would you like to be part of it? Lots didn't even get back to me. One that will remain nameless just said, complete waste of time. Absolute waste of time. Stupid idea. Yeah, we don't work with them. They still exist. But a lot of people got it and said, yes, we'd love to be part of it. The hardest venue to tap into was the London venue. And eventually we went with the Half Moon in Putney. Oh. And we announced, and I remember the morning that we announced, because it was just me, and the press on it went wild. And I was so excited, but also a bit shocked. And the reaction to it was fantastic. And somebody actually said, oh, it's back again. I said, no, but it's great that you feel that it feels like something that has been around. And then I was out with Stephanie Hardwick, who's our accountant, and although they don't talk publicly about who their clients are, after The Guardian did a whole one-page spread on them a couple of years ago, we were also out with Colin Greenwood. And
legend.
Absolute legend, a true gentleman, in fact, as is Philip Selway. And we were out for lunch, and he was just saying, you know, one of the things that Radiohead loved doing almost above everything else is being out on tour. And I thought about it, and a couple of days later I rang him and I said, would you mind if I just pass this on to you? I've come up with this idea, and just let me know what you think, and I'll call you back this afternoon. And he rang me back within half an hour. He said, this is great, what can I do to help? And I was like, oh, maybe you could be an ambassador. And he's like, fantastic. And Radiohead weren't doing a great deal at the time, so he did lots of press for us, and people were keen to hear from him. And he did a brilliant interview with Drowning Sound, and they said it was the biggest story they'd had that year, because Colin was talking about what Radiohead were up to, and everyone was keen to hear. So I think we've been incredibly fortunate. I mean, I always say we, because there's a team of four of us now. There's Chloe, who we call Colin. She's amazing. She runs IVW in the UK. We've got Charlie, known as Charlie Cables. He does all the production and logistics. And then we've got Oscar, who actually joined us during lockdown, who does all our comms and campaigns. So it's a really small, lean team. And I think we would have grown and developed much more of what we'd been doing if we had more people. But we can't have more people until we have more money. And we can't get more money until, I don't know, it's
a
just
pandemic
a,
goes.
Well, yeah, but even before that, I think it's just tough to getting buy-in from the industry, and you know, we're pushing hard on that this year. But we've never really taken any backward steps, and I've been very adamant about that. We won't tackle something unless I think we can do it really well. And so actually, back in 2018, when we launched in the US, there was a long time for that to build and for us to feel confident. And in fact, we looked at Australia first, but they weren't ready because they were having problems with the lockout laws. And although I was over there for a month, and somebody said, well, just run it in Victoria, the state of Victoria, I said, absolutely not. What's magical about IBW is that it's countrywide, everybody gets treated equally. And if you start to do pockets, then you're alienating people. And live music is, you know, a very national thing, an international thing, obviously. But so we partner with Marauder over in the US, who've done an amazing job of delivering IBW over 2 years. And this year, IVW in America happens after Independence Day. So obviously they've missed their one, but Moose, who's the founder of Marauder, of course he's called Moose, I've known for about 12 years. And there was nobody else I really wanted to speak to about running Independent Venue Week in America. You know, he has radio experience, you know, commercial experience, music industry experience. And in fact, they have things called town halls over in America, which are group get-togethers to discuss issues. And because of IVW, he was doing a town hall, and the venue community recognised that they didn't have a body to represent them. And within, I think it was 5 days, he was messaging me. I remember it well on WhatsApp, and I don't think he slept in 5 days, and he said, we've set up NIVA, the National Independent Venue Association. And within 2 months, they had 2,500 members all across the country. And these venues now have a collective voice. And I think he was a founding partner, but they've got a number of people helping to make that happen. And they're lobbying government again, perhaps not the best government to have in place. Well, for anybody, but especially creative industries. So I think it's, I'm sorry, I've rambled so long. I've forgotten the question.
Well, so this is what I wanted to ask, because there'll be a lot of musicians listening to this who will be in jobs right now that they hate and they think they're getting nothing from, but it's a means to an end whilst they're developing as musicians. And when you began that, you talked about your job in marketing that you kind of snored at and was like, oh, you know,
it's the IT and the socks and sandals I snored at, but the marketing skills.
So this is what I was going to say. So you talked about people being polite as being a great way to start a gig, and that's a very transferable skill that you could learn in any situation. Looking back, even though you might have been a bit cynical about that, what was worthwhile about that in regards to where you are now? What skills did you think you actually learned that you are applying now and helped you on your journey to...
Okay, yeah, I think it's really interesting, because there will be lots of artists that are doing jobs. You know, I've worked in pubs and bars, I've been a waitress, I've picked fruit in the pouring rain in bare feet. I think work ethic is a really strong thing that you definitely learn. And it's really tough, isn't it? Because nobody really wants to do a job that they hate. We spend more time at work than we do anywhere else, and we spend more time with work people than we do with our loved ones. So you really need to try and make it count. I think a hard work ethic, and I think being prepared to do something that you might not love in order to either save money or learn some new skills or keep yourself busy. There's nothing worse than being idle. It's so bad for your mental health, and I think we've seen that a lot across COVID, and I'm no exception. There's been times when I've been, you know, not in a good place, and we make sure we talk in the office regularly. I check in with everybody and we all share our thoughts. And I think in answer to your question, if you're an artist and you're listening to this and you're doing a job that's not where you expect to be in 5 years, nothing is forever unless you want it to be. I know people who've been on tour with big bands, and they've played 2,000-3,000 arenas, and they've got back off tour after a 6-month tour, and the next day they're in a call center. That is the reality right now, and has been for as long as I can remember. But just don't give up hope. And again, it comes back to that thing of listening. If you've been doing this for 2 or 3 years and you don't feel like you're getting your break, take a step back. Speak to some other people. You know, there's so many good resources that you can approach. There's so many events that you can go to. BBC Introducing Live, The Great Escape. Go to these events. Make an effort to get to know people. And I know for people who have crippling shyness, that don't have that confidence, I get it. I know it's tough. But if you want to make a change, sometimes you have to take yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone. And go with somebody if that's what helps. Try and find email addresses for people. Tag them up on social media. Be polite, because actually people are there to help you. They really are. And there's so many resources out there to give you support and guidance. And I think also BBC Introducing and the way that you can upload your material has been proven time and time again to be a fantastic resource to getting your music heard. Be creative. When I first started working with my brother, and he was managing a band, his plugger wasn't getting much luck on radio. And I think Chris Moyles was doing the breakfast show on Radio 1, so I went down to Hamleys and bought a kind of miniature camper van, printed all the faces of Chris Moyles' crew off on paper and stuck them inside the van, and went to Pret and got breakfast and delivered it to the radio station. I did that 3 days running, and eventually they started talking about the band that he was managing and where they were playing, and it's quite good fun to be creative. Try something a bit different.
I mean, that was actually going to be one of my next two questions. So Picasso once said, all children are born artists. The challenge is to remain an artist as you grow older. So within all this world, what is your creative outlet?
Oh, that's a really good question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. What's my creative? I think pulling IVW together, creating it, making it happen, I think one of the things that has surprised me most about Independent Venue Week, and I will forever be grateful, is the opportunity to travel around the country and meet the most incredible people and to be inspired by them. And we talk about Hull an awful lot. Jacko that runs the Adelphi up there. We took Norman Cook there. I met Norman on a EU march, told him that Jacko was still there. We had a chat during the march and he agreed to go up and play. But the Adelphi Club has a very close relationship to the Warren, which is a young people's project. It's run by young people, for young people. They've got a music division. Go to the Trades Club in Hebden Bridge, you walk in and there's a big plaque on the wall saying by the people, for the people. It's a very much a community-minded space. You've got Pop Rex up in Sunderland, run by Frankie and the Heartstrings. They do a huge amount of community work. And I think I see and watch so many people doing amazing things. And I guess my creative output is to try and work with them and come up with ideas, either because I'm inspired by them or taking their ideas and working with them to come up with new ideas that we can bring to life. Because a lot of the people that we meet are doing things in a local area. We'd like to help take those amazing ideas and stories around the country. So it's all about finding ways to be creative about that. And in fact, what we were due to launch at the start of this year was our Yes We Can platform, which is all about enabling people to grow skills, learn new things, meet other people in similar industries or similar groups. And I think what we really would like to do is help the venues to become more sustainable beyond just live music. So many venues are not open during the day. They open at 3 or 4 for sound check. And there are so many community groups around the country who are looking for space to do things. Perfect. And there are venues all around the country in city centres, towns, tiny villages that would welcome the chance to host people. And I think Independent Venue Week was set up to encourage people to either go back to gigs if they'd stopped going or to get off their screens and go to a night out. And I think what we'd like to do with Yes We Can is help to build that activity during the day. So there'll be activity for parents and toddlers. There'll be skills training from some of the best people in the industry for young people. There'll be groups from the LGBTQ plus community that want to get together and share experiences. There'll be groups for people advocating for mental health and well-being. We want to address loneliness, mainly in older people, but weirdly not just older people. We want to look at music and dementia. We've also got some really great relationships with disabled artists and people from the disabled community. And I think there are so many opportunities to get people through the doors of venues, obviously safely during COVID, but ultimately to engage with other people in their communities and to use the venues to do that. So my creative outlet is to look at these amazing things that are happening and see if we can find ways to consolidate it. And that's what Yes We Can will be doing. It'll be like Independent Venue Week, but year round. And we're really excited about finally, hopefully, making it happen.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because as many regular listeners know, that I do a lot of sessions on well-being, and having a creative outlet is kind of central. We always must make sure we've got some kind of creative outlet. Even if you're playing to an empty room or if you're no one's listening to your music, as long as you're getting it out of you, that's really important. So yeah. It's always important that we have that. Now, there's something you touched upon a moment ago, which I think was when we did the last episode of the podcast, which was a little bit self-indulgent, when James Dale of Goldheart Assembly interviewed me because the podcast was 5 years old. I said the thing I was most surprised at was actually what you touched upon there. You said that, you know, bands can go on tour for 6 months and play really big venues, and the next day they're kind of in a call center. And actually, do you think that that's kind of, in a strange way, seen as a bit of a dirty secret in the music industry? And actually, if we were just kind of, we normalised that and people were aware of that, it might deter, like it might stop other musicians who think, oh, this isn't working out, stopping music and going and get a full-time job. Like, do you think that's a bit of a secret? Oh, so-and-so's got a job.
It's a really interesting question, isn't it? Because I guess, I've never really thought about it like that, but I guess yes would be the answer. But yes, I guess, is the answer. I think there's a lot of people at very early stages of their career where it's common knowledge that they work in a pub. And I guess also it may come down to the work that you're doing when you are working. Mm-hmm. Call center has those connotations, doesn't it? Working in a pub, slightly better. Maybe doing some online training sessions for people, being a teacher, working in a supermarket. I think it depends what the work is as to how much you feel able to talk about it. Everybody has to keep themselves going, and there is the internet opened up the opportunity for everybody to be heard, their music to be heard. The flip side of that is everybody can be heard, which means that it's harder to get cut through. If you asked any musician, and this is why I abhor these talentless music shows, if you asked any musician, would they like 2 years of high fame and everything that came with it, or a career that saw them through for life? Anyone worth their salt would say they'd like a career for life. And if you look at the venues, this is something we talk about quite a lot. If you look at the trajectory of an artist, they'll go on tour and they might play the grassroots music circuit for a couple of years, but then they'll hopefully steadily grow. They'll play bigger venues and festivals. The venues never change. They are always there at the entry level. They can't, well, Nathan up at the Brudenell is one of the exceptions to this. They can't grow bigger. He's, you know, other than the Sage Gateshead,
Is that the one that extended it in the film?
They've extended it, yeah. So they built a new venue, but people can't generally do that. They can't up the size of their venue. They're still the ones at the grassroots taking risks. So as tough as it is for musicians, it's also tough for venues. And I think it's just about that belief. And if you're really struggling as an artist and you've been doing this 5 or 10 years, it's okay to stop. Even if you stop for a year and come back to it, you've got to have the passion for it. Without the passion, I think it becomes really clear that your heart's not in it. And it's okay to take a break. It's okay to try other things. I think there's such an amount of pressure, isn't there, when you're an artist to have that success, to be signed, to be doing all these tours. And of course, it's fantastic. But I think feeling self-worth with what you're doing is so important. So even if you're doing a part-time job, but your music is fulfilling you and it's not the only thing that's financially contributing to your existence, it's far better than being in a band that you hate, doing tours that you don't love and sustaining yourself, because that sends you off, like you're saying, with mental health in other paths.
What's a band that, or an artist that you might have worked with that many of our listeners may not know, that maybe slipped through the net, or you think that we could go back and listen to and think, I know you've probably got loads.
That's a really tough question. When you were talking earlier about Gold Heart Assembly, and
tell me about it.
Years and years ago, we put them on at the, what was the venue called next to La Scala? It was, used to be a festival. We did an upstairs room there. We used to do nights, but Gold Heart Assembly were an extraordinary band, still are an extraordinary band. Steve Lamacq was a huge fan, and it was that a case of, why isn't everybody on board with this? Why aren't people not getting more behind it? Why do people not see how great it is? And of course, music is subjective. And there's a number of circumstances why things go the way they go.
They're doing a third album, by the way.
So there you go.
Which they may be having that break helped, like exactly what you said.
Who knows, right? But I think you look at Amanda Palmer, who very famously has got on as a DIY artist, and actually the trappings of the major label and the music industry do not interest her, and she's done very, very well out of it. It's quite interesting, because when we did the very first year of Independent Venue Week and Colin was ambassador, and we worked with BBC Introducing and we discussed bands that we'd like to play, and he picked Glass Animals to headline.
Oh, nice.
Which was fantastic. Nobody had heard of them at that point. And it was an extraordinary show, and we all absolutely loved it. And of course, he was very gracious and stayed behind after, and we chatted to the band. And they have gone on to do extremely well, especially in spite of the accident that happened. And I think, what is a measure of success? How do people view that now? Do you want a number one? Do you want a sellout tour? Do you want a number of streams? Is it followers? I think success is a combination in varying degrees of all of those things, but are you fulfilled with it? Can you sustain yourself? Is this delivering? Is this making you happy? And are you able to enjoy life doing it?
Bob Dylan said on success is when someone gets up in the morning and then goes to bed, 12 hours later or 14 hours later, and in between has done exactly what they want for the day.
Yeah,
that's your measurement of success.
That's a really simple way of looking at it, isn't it? And I think there is no career that doesn't have its challenges. Even with Independent Venue Week, we have blood, sweat and tears, literally, sometimes. And I think we liken it very often to having a baby, because there are 9 months and now more, obviously, of planning and, a real roller coaster. But the result, the labour, although it's 7 days, which you wouldn't want for a real pregnancy, is just glorious. We get around the country and we meet people that we've been emailing and we see venues and you're like, oh, I didn't expect it to look like this, or this is exactly how I expected it to look. And generally people are really happy to see you, and it's the best week of my year. Excuse me, hands down, best week of my year. It's exhausting and knackering, and we do a lot of driving and there's not much sleep, but you come out of it totally sated and euphoric and humbled and can't wait to do it all again.
So given your experience and everything that you've, you know, seen, and from, you know, every side of the fence, if you like, in the music industry, let's pretend I'm a new artist, I've written some good songs, I'm getting some interesting things are happening. What am I most vulnerable to in that situation? What are the things I should be doing or being aware of so I'm not exploited?
I think there are people out there that make lots of promises, whether it's live, whether it's publishing, opportunities to be signed. If something seems too good to be true, chances are it's are. With promoters, you've got to watch out for that awful pay to play. I think, you know, we talk about this quite a lot. If you're at that point, so you've obviously got some connections within the industry, one of the best places to hang out and get advice and experience is a venue. If you don't know anybody in a venue, if you don't know anybody in the industry, the easiest foot in the door you can have is to a venue, because you're going to meet a sound tech, you're going to meet an artist, and you're going to meet probably some managers. And I think the thing to do is, whenever somebody approaches you, I mean, social media is great for this nowadays, you can do a lot more research, but chat to other bands, go and see other bands, go to venues regularly, get to know the team there, get to know the external promoters, get to know the in-house team, and just sound people out, especially if you're working in a local area. Word of mouth is very important. Do your research and just try not to get caught out. Don't rush into something. If you're being approached by somebody and they're pushing hard for you to sign a deal, take a breath. Anybody that's worth their salt will give you the time and space to make the right decision. If somebody's trying to push something on you, the chances are it's better for them than it is for you. Just hanging out in your community and seeing what's what is a really good way, because although there are some bad eggs still out there, their reputation does tend to precede them. So find out what's going on and chat to people. I think it's probably the best advice I could give.
What's the most important piece of music memorabilia you own?
Oh,
you must have some interesting stuff.
Oh, that's an awful question.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. Oh my God.
Okay, so if the house is burning down and everybody's looked after and everything's okay, what's the thing you're grabbing?
Other than family photos?
Of course, yeah, music related.
Just the vinyl collection, but yeah. How, I mean, it's out of order at the moment. I was very fortunate once. I was on Gumtree. This is a very long-winded way of telling you a story, but I was on Gumtree once and I was looking for some photo frames, and this woman said she had some photo frames, so I drove down to her house in Euston and I walked in and the flat was pretty much being packed up, and in front of me was a box of photo frames, and to my left was two boxes of records, albums, and another box of singles. And I just stopped and went, what are these? And she said, oh, I'm packing up my life here. I'm going to live in Turkey and I'm selling everything. And I was like, okay, can I just look through your records? And I ended up sitting down and chatting to her for an hour. She was in her 60s. And she had been all through the swinging 60s around Carnaby Street. Her record collection mirrored my taste in music. Wow. So she had loads of Beatles stuff. There was the White Album in there, Led Zeppelin. There was a lot of jazz and classical music. And we chatted for an hour and I said, just for you artists out there that are still broke, this is not that long ago and I was still skint. And I said, how much do you want for them? And she said, I don't know. And I said, well, I'll tell you now, if you can let me have them, I've no interest in selling them on. She said, I have a lot of people that want to buy them and sell them. I said, I won't do that. I will play them. And she let me have them all for 50 quid, which was incredible.
Bargain.
So I play those regularly, and that's really special. I think, I don't know that I have much beyond that. I'm not very good at asking for things for myself. I've got endless T-shirts, and you can see all the badges and things, but I don't really have anything personalised, because I'm great at asking for other people. If you want gig tickets or something for a good cause, I'm right there, but me asking for myself, not so much.
Thank you for sharing. Which gig did you experience that you wish you could go back and re-experience again, if there was just one?
Wow. You're pulling them all out today, aren't you? If there was one that I could... Possibly Prince at Coco.
Oh, wow.
He did a kind of...
I had two friends who went to it and I could have
gone. Well, I knew the manager at Coco really well at the time. And he rung me up at 11 o'clock at night and said, get yourself down in the next half hour and I'll let you in. And I said to my flatmate, do you want to go and see Prince? She said, I've just got out of the shower. I said, I don't think he gives a shit how you look. Get some clothes on, we're going. And we turned up and, you know, Coco's not a small grassroots music venue, but it's certainly not the O2 and I've seen him there too. And it was magical, absolutely magical. And I think I'd, partly because he's not alive anymore, so we know it can't happen. I think I'd really love to see that. You asked me on a different day, it might be something different. Seeing Radiohead at the Roundhouse, was that 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. It was pretty spectacular. I cry a lot of gigs, I'm hopeless. But if something's really special, I find it really hard to keep my emotions in check. And I don't really care because I'm having that sort of time.
Something you said earlier, which is interesting, where you said, get off your screen and go out. In regards to, like, you know, there's a lot of us can be on our phones, and et cetera, et cetera. And it jogged my memory that a guy called Christian Madden came on the podcast, who's Liam Gallagher's keyboardist. And he said this thing, is he said that Prince would never be as good a guitarist as he was if he'd spent all of his time having to manage his social media, like as a youngster, I've got to check you, how do I look for my Instagram post, stuff like that. He was channeling his skills, you know, as an amazing guitarist and songwriter and performer. I think that's just really a pertinent thing to mention, given that you said Prince.
Well, we do spend too much time on social media, and there is a place for it and a time for it. I've got friends that have come off everything. I came off Facebook about 5 years ago. I've calmed down on Twitter. Mental health wise, that's a thing. Life's more complex now. And in 5 years time, who knows what's going to be in our world that's going to mean that we have less time for the things that matter. It's tough, but it was a good comment.
If you I know this is such a difficult
you're
question,
you're going to pull another one out, aren't you?
So fast forward 30 years from now,
I'll be 80.
What do you think the music industry will look like? And there's no right or wrong answer about this. What do you think the music industry will look like in 30 years from now, and there's no right or wrong answer.
Okay, what do I think it'll look like in 30 years? I think there'll be a lot of people in care homes like me that won't be wanting to listen to Frank Sinatra, but will be wanting to listen to a guy called Gerald and the like. I hope that the music industry will be... I would like to think there will be more parity. I'd like to think that there will be more transparency, more opportunity for people who... aren't blessed with natural entitlement, whether it be funding or resource. I'd like it to be far more representative on stage and behind the scenes of the, you know, the world that we live in. And I'd like to think that people are still having a bloody good time going to gigs on any scale. I think if we lose that... if people just revert to their screens, you can go to a gig, two nights on the trot, in the same venue with the same lineup and the same audience, and they will be very different nights, right? Even if the band plays the same set in the same order, that's the bit that we cannot quantify or change, and nor do we want to. That is what makes live music so compelling. And I hope that whatever else is going on in terms of structure, I hope that it's fair, and I hope that people are still loving going to gigs.
Thank you for sharing. So tell us a bit more about the Yes We Can and the Council of Independent and what's coming up in the next year.
Well, I'll just quickly just talk in case anybody wants to find out a bit more about the Council of Independent Live Music. We've got some social channels. We're on Twitter at @live_council and the same for Instagram at @live_council. Facebook, which is Council Live Music, and there's an email address, livemusiccouncil@gmail.com. If you're interested, if you're a freelancer or an independent and you want to find out more about how that platform might be able to help you, that's where you can get in touch. I think right now, I mean, where are we now? Sort of early, mid-September? We'd be in the thick of IVW planning and we'd be thinking about our launch event, which we started 3 years ago. We'd do a live lunchtime event just to announce who the ambassador is and some key facts about what we're doing. This year, partly because of the funding situation. We have Arts Council emergency funding, which will see us through to the end of October. We are project funded. We're a small team. We don't have any investors. We don't have any backers. Thank God for Arts Council England, because they have made it possible for us to see through the summer. And we've got a couple of Arts Council applications in now. We've had some support pledged from some parts of the industry. See tickets have come in as a partner. But we're working furiously now to try and get some other funding. Otherwise, we won't be able to deliver Independent Venue Week. But we are blindly going on, like Roadrunner running off the edge of the cliff. If we don't look down, it will be okay. We're doing a big push about what we think Independent Venue Week will be like. Nobody knows. We cannot plan far ahead enough to be certain about anything, because if you look at what's happening now, restrictions are changing weekly.
Yeah.
So what we've done with our planning for Independent Venue Week is send out to our whole community and say, these are the things that we can do. If we can get into a venue and do a live show, we'd love you to do that with us. If we can get into a venue and do a live show with an audience that's safe and it's a full capacity, fantastic. If we can get into a venue with either a limited capacity or no audience, but it's possible to have a band in to record and stream a session, we will also do that. But this year, unusually, what we're also suggesting is asking artists to get involved in different ways. So we're offering them the chance, and this can either be in a venue or virtually on the old Zoom thing with a venue as much as a partner, but to start to do some in conversations and interviews. So there'll be opportunities to talk about tour diaries and the album behind a tour. So if we could get Primal Scream to talk about Screamadelica and where they played and what it meant, I'd be there, right? We're also suggesting to people that maybe to do an album playback. So for a seminal album that might have meant something to you, to talk about the process of making that album and how it all came together, because I think people are still interested in that. We launched a series during lockdown called Take Five, where an artist would interview another artist.
You had Soak interview an old classmate of mine called Billy Nomate.
Oh, Tor, amazing. Yeah, we love Tor, yeah. Actually, when we started Take Five, we kind of hoped that it would be a mixture of artists, venues, promoters, everybody within the industry, but it's literally gone from artist to artist to artist. That's fine. And it's just, it's them interviewing each other. And then through social media, ahead of the interview, we ask people to submit questions. And then the host will ask the guest five of those questions. They take five of the questions. And then the following week, that week's guest becomes then the host, and they choose who they want to speak to. So we'd like to continue that and do a big push on that. If we can do it live so we can get two artists in a venue, great. But if not, we'll get them on screen. And also Big Jeff, the wonderful Big Jeff Johns, who was our very first non-artist ambassador and still a huge part of the IVW family. He's been doing a series of interviews called The Big Jeff Chat. Jeff's always been very public about his mental health and his learning disability, and he's a great advocate for openness, and his passion for music is unbelievable. What's also been interesting for him, because Jeff goes to a gig, at least one gig every night, and has done for 12 years. So lockdown brought a very different situation for him. And it was interesting because he was in the car. We were driving round in January. He was on tour with us for Independent Venue Week, and then we went our separate ways halfway through the week. And we'd have Six Music on so we could stay in touch with what was being covered there. And an artist would come on air and he'd go, oh, yeah, but the drummer in this band also played with the bass player in that band, and then they did this other. And his knowledge was just phenomenal. And I said to him at the time, Jeff, we should set you up to do an interview series, because you're not a journalist. I think artists will want to speak to you. And you're not a overexcited fan, so they'll feel comfortable. But your knowledge and your passion is so strong. So when lockdown happened, I said, let's start the series. Who would you like to speak to? We came up with a list, and you'll see him now literally just on Twitter saying, so-and-so, do you want to do a chat? Steve Davis replied straight away, he's going to do a chat. The first one was with Bill Ryder-Jones, and I fell in love with Bill watching that interview. And it's been great for Jeff to have that opportunity. So we'd like, if we can get him out into venues, to be able to do those in person, because I think that would be really
great.
And
he came across so well in the film as well. He's great in the film.
Oh, he's so passionate. I wish we could have done a whole film on him. We've got footage. We might yet still do that.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So you know, you said this is the single biggest threat to the music music venues ever, the COVID. And I know you said that a couple of months ago, but, you know, hopefully everything will smooth out, you know, smooth itself out. And I think some of the ideas you came up with there, which is, you know, they're great, even if it isn't exactly as it was in the past. I think doing some of those things sounds great. I really, really like the idea, you know, what's our call to arms for our listeners? Well, the thing you said earlier about kind of double the frequency of the amount you go to venues, you know, when things open up. So if you go once a week, go twice a week. If you go once a month, go twice a month, et cetera, et cetera. And even if it is just once a year, go twice a year. I really, really like that message. So thank you so much for joining us, Sybil. What you do is so, so important, as we've heard, and kind of you're keeping us all to account, which I really love. You know, ensuring that there's, you know, an environment for the next great, you know, generation of artists to develop. Keep that fight alive. And our army of listeners are going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you on this and support you along the way. Good luck with the film.
Thank you very
long
much.
Long and Winding Road. I've watched it and it's excellent. It's really, really fascinating.
Yes, we should be finding out about a release date for that. There's been some things that we've had to get through this year, but we've now got the title back in our hands, so we can get it out there in the right time and in the right place.
And Clive Deamer said something interesting about the film. He said that it's almost like an artifact now, because it was just before coronavirus.
Yes.
You know, and it's almost like this is what the world
it
was
really
like.
Was, as well. And that's the thing, you know, we've been very keen to get it back out on air, because that's the thing that everybody's missing is, you know, we're really proud of how the film ended up. We had to do a lot of work on the creative direction of it, and what we wanted people to come away with was a sense that they just need to get to a gig.
Yeah.
They can just sense it and they can just feel it, and I think that's what we've ended up with. And yeah, Clive features in the film with Get the Blessing, and we're just making sure that the time and the place that we put the documentary out will have the most impact.
Great. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me,
podcast.
Chris, and thank you everyone for listening. And if you want to find out any more information about what we're doing, then you can go to independentvenueweek.com.
So that was Sybil Bell, and thank you for joining us, Sybil. Really thought-provoking stuff there for me, really eye-opening to see where we are now and where we're going to in the future. And, you know, for me, I'd be amazed by the time that Sybil retires if she's not celebrated or recognised in some way for what she's doing. It really is an incredible job what she's doing. And, you know, my kind of call to arms to all our listeners are, you know, when you do start going back to gigs, take photos and say, look, I'm doubling the amount of times that I'm going to independent venues, and tag in Independent Venue Week, tag in ourselves, so that we can see there's been some impact from this episode of the podcast, because I think that's a real achievable goal for all of us, that we visit independent venues once they reopen, twice as much as we currently do. I think it's a really nice aim for all of us. So do tell us about where you're going, you know, take photos, tag us in, and we'd love to share them. Okay, we will see you next time.